David Campos and Maceo Montoya, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
David, do you prefer David or David?
That doesn't matter, to be honest.
Okay, I'm not sure because sometimes people see me and say Daniel or Daniel, and that's exactly what I say. It doesn't matter. But Maceo, it probably does matter that we call you Maceo and not Messio.
That's right. I played on a soccer team and it was like the 35 and older, the Veterano League. And they couldn't figure out Maceo. So they called me Masi. And I was like, it's a little bit too similar to Messi. And I was like the worst player on the team. So I felt like I didn't deserve that similarity.
That's funny. Well, David Campos, let me just introduce you. You are a Canto Mundo Fellow. You are the author of Furious Dusk from the University of Notre Dame Press, which won the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. Andres Montoya, who happens to be Messi's brother. Sorry, Maceo's late brother. David, your poems have appeared in every journal that has good poetry. You teach English at Fresno City College, and you've been on the show before. Welcome, welcome back, and congratulations on this book. Maceo, you are an artist. You do paintings and drawings, but you are also a writer, fiction writer, and a nonfiction writer. You have multiple books. I lost count after The Scoundrel and The Optimist. That came out in 2010. And then suddenly there was Deportation of Wapa Barraza, You Must Fight Them, Letters to the Poet from His Brother. And now I think there's probably three other titles I don't even know about, but I do know you have another one coming out or just came out, Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces, which I'm looking forward to talking to you on a future show. But welcome to Words on a Wire. And we're here to talk about this amazing collaboration called American Quasar, put out by Red Hen Press. The first thing I need to ask is why Quasar? As most people might understand if they Google it, if they look at the Wikipedia, a quasar is this massive celestial body that just emits so much energy that we could actually observe it 4 billion light years away or something like that through a telescope, and it looks like a big star. Why? What is it about quasar and American quasar? What energy is it that you might be playing with here?
Well, at least when I first started to kind of like look for different titles or the possibility of a title, I was really looking at the larger themes of what was going on in the book and what was going on with the writing in general. And there was a term that I read in some kind of scientific article. You know, I'm not a scientist. I don't claim to be one, right? So I don't know all the specifics, but I remember in this one article about these two like black holes kind of like circling one another and then colliding to become these like supermassive black holes. And that some of them existed in the center of galaxies and some of them were active. And there was a theory that said, hey, this is a possibility of why quasars exist. It's because while they are simultaneously bringing in and destroying all this matter and condensing it into very small particulates, right? It is also at the same time spewing out all of this matter. So it is both destructive and creating at the same time. And I was just like, this is kind of interesting, right? Especially when you think about transformative moments or transformations in general, right? Like then a supermassive black hole or a quasar is in fact a transformation process. And so when I was thinking about American Quasar as a title, I was thinking about, oh, it's an American transformation, right? A more particular of the speaker within the poems, but even some of the thought process that are happening inside of it.
And I get the sense as I'm reading this poem, this book of poems, it's an assumption I have, which could be wrong because my assumptions have been wrong before, but that a lot of these poems were in dialogue with or were correlated somehow to the times that we just recently experienced with the George Floyd protests going around all over the country during a time when people were afraid to leave their homes and the paranoia was increasing and it looked like maybe even the end of the American experiment. Is there some sort of use of that energy in this book that contributes to the American quasarness?
Marcel is nodding yes, but I was like, to a certain extent, because the original, at least the draft, was written like 2015, 2016. So that was way before any of the current political climate. But some of that kind of leaked into this, and that kind of energy did leak into it. I mean, the opening poem is kind of compiled from different images from the news, right? So on one end, I had what was going on.
Well, I love this line on the poem called Your Country, where it says, "Your darkness is too much like the centers of galaxies surrounded by the protest of the stars as they march into you in rebellion." I mean, I love that for the imagery, but I also love it because there are metaphorical possibilities of applying it to the political landscape of, for the last pandemic years, it seemed like it was going on to an extreme level. But if you're a Latinx activist, you know this has been going on for, hundreds of years, right? There's some sort of activism in this book that I really admire. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about.
I can speak to, so the original title was American House Fire, and that's one of the poems in the book. And, I felt like that first draft, we were definitely kind of thinking about decay, about burning down. And it's interesting to draw the distinction that David made between, say, an American House Fire and an American Quasar, where a quasar is also kind of burning out, but it's also generative. And that first draft, where it was, with the title American House Fire, this was the rise of Trump. This was kind of like the beginning of what has ended with, the pandemic and the George Floyd protests but the signs were all there. And as you pointed out, Daniel, those of us who have been active and have been aware of these issues, nothing has changed, right? Maybe the temperature has been turned up, but all of these issues have been there for generations. And so I felt like the poems were addressing these issues, but in this way that it was like, how does the body internalize these issues, right? And then how does the body kind of turn outward and reflect upon the landscape? And in a way, and David and I have talked about this, how does that all kind of come together to form a notion of citizenship and how we view ourselves within the body politic?
Well, it's a powerful collection. And my first instinct when I was reading it, the poems and the book of the written part of it, apart from the art, the written part of it is, it's a book. I mean, it's not just an arbitrary collection of poems. Here's enough poems to make a book, but it seems like it has arcs, has dramatic arcs, thematic arcs. It has interactive imagery that comes back. And so my assumption at first, David, was that this was your book before before Maceo was involved with it. Tell me about my assumption.
You are completely wrong. about that assumption. It was initiated by Francisco Aragon out of Letras Latinas, who reached out to Maceo and I and proposed this idea of creating a screen print that mixes poetry and an image in order to fundraise for the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. And Maceo and I met briefly when I visited UC Davis. And we talked about this concept or this idea, and we initiated that kind of process by going off of one particular line from Furious Dusk, which was on the precipice of violence and what that meant and what that really meant for all of us. We left, we went our separate ways. I went back to Fresno. A few months later, I created this poem. I sent it to him. And that's where that process kind of began barreling toward what came to this conclusion. So I didn't create an entire collection of poems and then send it to him. I sent him a draft of a poem And he sent me five images. And I was just like, oh, okay, you're going to send me five images? I'm going to send you five new poems, right? Oh, and it was just like this burst of creative energy that I felt, you know, that was coming out of our discussions.
So you were like two different quasars on opposite sides of the landscape, sending energy to each other. And sucking energy.
It's true, but I guess, you know, again, the separation, right? Like I feel like there were so many times where, you know, we kind of, not that we, you know, we fused as one, but this was unique in the sense that my other collaborations with poets or writers is I have, you know, been sent like the manuscript, or the poems might still be in process, but it was essentially done and the concept was kind of given to me and I responded to that. Whereas with David, we were kind of coming up with the concept together, not knowing where we were going to end up. And there's something very exciting about that because, you know, for one, we recognized, you know, that the themes of our work and the way that we're responding to one another, that we were pushing towards meaning. And I find that oftentimes our artists are kind of looked to like kind of match the meaning or replicate the meaning or illustrate the meaning. And that's less exciting than the process that David and I experienced, which was we're both kind of pushing our respective language to search for that moment, to search for that precipice. And I think we may have let go of the idea of the precipice of violence, but for me, what always stood out was we were working towards that precipice. And I understand the precipice when it comes to painting, right? You're kind of coming to that moment, that ledge, right? And I think the same thing with poetry is that you're working towards that ledge, towards that cliff, to that moment where, you know, the whole kind of, you know, vista spreads out before you. And, you know, that energy that we were drawing upon, you know, was very exciting for me as an artist. And to think about Francisco Aragon, who has kind of visionary in so many ways when it comes to bringing different people together, and he's had projects where he has commissioned all these different poets to write poems and then has commissioned the artists to respond to those poems. And those exhibitions have traveled the country. And then he's organized these ekphrastic poetry workshops to respond to the artwork and the traveling, you know, Latino art exhibition through the Smithsonian. And so he's kind of done it like both ways. And I think it's great that David and I, through that process, were given an opportunity to kind of discover a new way of working together.
You know, that's really important, that point that you're making, I think, because, you know, when we think of ekphrastic poetry, we think of a poet looking at a work of art and writing a poem. And I'm not quite sure if there's a term for it the other way around, an artist looking at a poem and creating the art after that. I don't know if there's such a term, but when I was looking at this, I was trying to understand how the images and the poems that are juxtaposed on the same page as the images, how they spoke to each other. And if indeed they were, the art was a representation of the poetry, or the poetry was a representation of the art. And I'm looking at this one poem called American Boy, which like a lot of the poems in this book just blew me away. But I love this line where it says, "I want to call out the sky's real name, even though my tongue has been sanded down from years of hushing my own." It's a beautiful line. And to me, it evokes a little bit of Andrés Montoya. Maybe it's the part about the sky's real name. There's some mystery in the sky that is connected to something way, way beyond what we could ever understand. But I'm wondering, when I look at the image on its side, it's somebody holding his head and screaming. And it almost looks like something that I would associate with an Andrés Montoya poem. And I'm wondering, is there a little bit of Montoya in this particular poem in specifically? And is there a collaboration going on between these two images, or are they just juxtaposed for the sake of the layout?
I would say that Andrés is a part of this poem, because when you start thinking about you know, the way that you generate writing, you're always looking back and maybe even subconsciously referencing these particular writers or poets that you've read in the past. And so they're always hovering in terms of their influence on the way that you write. But it wasn't a conscious choice, if you will, when I was drafting this one. And I don't necessarily know how we paired this particular poem with that particular image, but I just remember that particular image really striking me with this idea that when you have dealt with years of hushing your own name, how do you feel inside, right? Like it feels like in something that is overwhelming that you can't really say out loud. And when I saw this particular image, I don't know in what part of the generation process, Marcel, that you created this, but I was just like, oh my God, this is exactly that kind of sentiment that I was pushing for, at least on the language side of it.
No, so the line that's there, it was everything kept inside writhes and piles. I think that was the original line. And I'm not sure, David, if you ended up editing out or if it's in another poem, but that was an interesting part of the process was, you know, I would seize upon a line, right? I would see an image in it and I would riff kind of in a way on that line and create a couple of images. But then David kept editing the poems. My pieces were finished. And, you know, it's just kind of the nature of these different mediums. My work in a way was done in 2016, whereas David kept editing the poems and editing collection for the next couple of years, just by nature of what needs to be done to see to completion. Whereas mine were very much, they were monoprints, and I would ink up plexiglass and then I would scrape away, and I have only a limited amount of time that the ink remains live on the plexiglass. And then I would run it through the printing press, and then it's a complete experiment because you don't know what's going to come out on the other end, but then the piece would be done. And I mentioned that I had, you know, 30 something images that, that went along with David's poems, and only 19 ended up in the collection in the book. But so in a way that was like my editing process was, as we read through, where is the image most appropriate? Where are those notes where you almost are kind of expecting for there to be one of these images that follow the poem or that follow the line? And there's a handful in there where there's a direct correlation where the poem has a line that is then the image kind of drawn directly from that. But I would say like the line doesn't necessarily need to be there because Daniel, as you pointed out, I want to call out the sky's real name, and David talking about, you know, when one has been silenced, you know, what is the feeling that's inside? So all of you are drawn to other words, other language on the page that reflect this image, even though that original line has been edited out or moved.
That's interesting because, you know, you talked about David would send you a poem and you would send an image or vice versa. You'd work, you know, that. But then there was a certain point where your work was done and then the revision process started. And I'm wondering how much communication there was during that time. And did you ever get the urge to say, okay, wait a minute, add another little stroke here or there?
So the only additional strokes that were made was David came up. And I had him write out some of the lines on like Mylar, which is like a transparent kind of plastic page. And then we actually silk screen those lines onto the print. And so those were the only additions that were made where we took the poetry and put them on a couple of the images, not all of them. But, you know, I think that there was different parts of the editing process where, you know, I saw myself, I'm the artist in this, David's the poet. But I knew what that original kind of impulse was and what I drew from and what excited me. And so there were different kind of directions that David went in the course of the 2 years, and he would send me a draft. And, you know, we all find ourselves like insecure about the works that we've created. And I, not that I had to remind him, but I was like, kind of, David, there, you know, what about this that we kind of like seized upon, that we drew upon, you know, return to that, or like, why did you take this out? Or, and I'm hesitant because I don't consider myself a poet, but I knew what I drew upon. I knew the power that was in those poems, and I had to say something. But for the most part, the process was, you know, was separate. You know, David, you know, finding his way on the page.
That's funny because I could picture a scenario, which I'm sure didn't happen with you, but let's say that, you know, the poet writes this beautiful uplifting poem and the artist creates this uplifting image, but then in revisions 2 years later the poet finds the darkness in the poem and it's this really dark poem, but the image is like it wasn't that extreme. but you know, one of the things I like about this book is the poems allow themselves to not blatantly talk about what going on in this country and what has always been going on for people of color, for the oppressed, but that it's a Latinx book in the sense that it is aware, at least I'm probably just using too many words to say it's political. It has its political component. And it also, in doing so, ties itself to Latinx Chicano literature from the past. And I'm looking again at that same poem, American Boy, with that beautiful line that evoked Andres Montoya, which could, in a way, you know, being connecting to the Chicano poets. When Andres was writing, there was no such thing as a Latinx poet. We hadn't created that term yet. It was a Chicano poet. But this, the way it ends, it says, "I can't shake the tongueless boy, knowing I will never grasp how to love myself in color." I love this line, because it evokes two things for me. It evokes what's her name? Lorna D. Cervantes wrote in the poem to a young white man, asking me how I, blah, 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 you know, the poem, where she says, "Let me show you my wounds, my stumbling mind, my excuse me tongue, and this nagging preoccupation with the feeling of not being good enough." This poem, for me, evokes that issue that has been raised in Latinx poetry about being socialized to not accept ourselves for our color. And it's a very powerful ending. It's a devastating ending. I will never grasp how to love myself in color. Yet at the same time, you could take it as color on the level of physics and on the level of how we filter color into our reality. And I cannot except on another level, all these different realities that seem to be coloring my landscape. But anyway, I admire it because of its connection to the Latinx literary tradition. And I'm wondering if in the art or in the poetry itself, there were either conscious or unconscious arrivals at the awareness that, okay, this is in dialogue with Latinx literature and the political cultural aspects of it. Did that make sense at all?
No, absolutely it did. And I always think that when you're approaching the page, you're continuing a conversation that has already started. Right. And the conversation is already ongoing. It's going to continue after me. Right. And I'm just another voice adding my two cents to the ongoing conversation. And this is kind of like a repeated kind of theme, right? About not being able to really see yourself. And because you can't really see yourself, can you actually really love yourself? And at this particular moment, you know, for me, and what I was really beginning to grasp for myself was just like, hey, I've abandoned all parts of my parents' culture, right? Like I've abandoned all the things that would color my life personally, right? Especially my childhood, my upbringing. Those are things that I rebelled against and I said, I don't want to be a part of. And at this particular moment in my life, I was just like, hey, you know, like bring back that color, right? I want to be able to love myself in that particular color again, right? And so it was at that point where I started really to go back to the music that my parents would used to play, right? And begin there, right? With the music. Then it was the food. Then it was these other things that just continued on for me. And so when I was thinking of that line, I was thinking about all those different aspects that I saw in myself, all of those different aspects that I had read in previous books and poetry, where it was always about at least hiding who you were to a certain extent in order to assimilate, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that pull to assimilate in this country is really, really strong, right? And what it means to assimilate for everybody else is really different. And do you need to assimilate, right? Can you be a bicultural person here and exist mentally well, right? Like, or what does that all mean? And for me, that was an exploration of that kind of idea.
And I, you know, as far as the connection to Latinx poetry, Latinx literature and art, my painting is on the cover of David's first book, Furious Dusk. And I remember when I was working on that series, it was like these images that were very abstract to me. The images are still recognizable, still realist. But as far as what was being depicted seemed to me very abstract. It was the first kind of body of work where I wasn't necessarily like giving a voice to the voiceless, which is a way that I saw my work before. And I feel like continuing a tradition that, you know, from the Chicano movement, from my dad's work. But these were just kind of these scenes that I would imagine happening in the landscape. And so the image that is on David's book is a group of soccer players in the middle of a field. There's a haystack, this kind of ominous sky, and there's a fight that happens. And the painting is called Turning on One Another. And it's not a scene that I ever saw. It was just like, I was driving down the road and I see those haystacks and I see the sky and I pictured what would it be like if there's a soccer game out there and there's just like this brawl that happens. And I left the painting and it was just kind of this question mark. Like, what does this mean? How does this connect to Chicano art? How does this connect to the message, right? And yet, David chose that poem for his book, and you know, he connected to it as a Fresno story, or as like a poetry collection and stories rooted in Fresno and his experience. And you know, it's one of those moments where I felt like I had to learn to trust myself, like we as artists and poets have to learn to trust ourselves, that wherever our imaginations guide us or wherever our process guides us in our respective mediums, that it will become part of that larger landscape of Latinx literature and art, without necessarily consciously thinking about these are themes that I'm drawing upon that, you know, that relate or that one can, you know, recognize as the Latinx experience.